Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's show, I'm chatting to horror writer Robert Attoni about his brand new anthology, Her Infernal Names and Other Nightmares. Over the course of the interview, we talk about how the anthology started out as a novella, but before becoming a short story collection, how Robert finds himself more influenced by film than literature in his writing, and why so many of his stories end on an abrupt note or even on cliffhangers. We also discuss how he got into horror writing in the first place and why he thinks horror is the most powerful and flexible of all the genres. Plus a whole lot more besides that, which you can hear right now in my interview with Robert. Hi, Robert. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So we have you on the show today to talk about your new short story collection, Her Infernal Names and Other Stories. For the listeners, can you give a kind of brief overlook of what the collection is, spoiler-free overlook synopsis?
Sure, sure, absolutely. It is a collection of short horror stories anchored by the title novella, Her Infernal Name, and it's a lot of the stories have to do with fear. Mostly a lot of the stories center around, you know, some kind of fear that I think we all kind of harbor as people, and, you know, fear of the future, fear of the environment, fear of the economy, fear of one another, past, all of that kind of stuff. So a lot of the stories are very much so rooted in that.
And did you write all of the stories specifically for this collection? Or did you have stories that you just thought would fit into this collection? And how did that process go in terms of like collating what stories would be in the finished product?
I did write all of them specifically for the collection. I didn't really know any other way to assemble short stories. I always thought, well, if you write a short story collection, it's all the stories that are in there are going to be in that collection. But then I realized a lot of my favorite authors put together their short story collections based on stories that were published in other outlets and stuff like that. So I had one story in there that was published with another outlet, and all the other ones were written for the collection, though. The novella, it all started with the novella. I had, there was an open call for a story that had to do with demon, you know, you had to write some kind of a story that dealt with demonology. And I started writing that, and it just kept going and going and going. And I was like, well, I've gone way past how many pages this should be for the, you know, the call that I'm trying to submit for. So I'm just going to keep going. And it turned into a novella.
And what made you... what made you turn it into a short story collection as well? Like instead of maybe extending out the novella and just releasing the novella?
I think short story is a lot of fun to play around with. I think more often than not, you can really, if you're really economical, you can get in and get out with a short story and sort of punch the reader with what you want to hit them with. And in a way that, you know, in a novel or in a novella, it's a little more dragged out. The novella in this collection is very old school. It feels to like in writing it, I wanted to sort of create like that 70s level of paranoia that you see in film. But the short stories that surround it, follow it rather, they're all what I saw in my head is like, okay, this would be like a cool Twilight Zone-y type thing. And I just think the short form is so much more fun than a full-length novel, even though I've written two full-length novels, but they're not horror. Well, they have horror elements, but I find so much more enjoyment in short stories.
And how did you go picking about the kind of themes and the different styles of horror as well? Because like I feel like you've obviously covered a lot of ground. It seems like you didn't want to just kind of focus in on like one type of horror. You flung in different types, from like survival horror to kind of like, you know, traditional kind of monsters, and you know, there's a zombie tale, there's a vampire tale, you know, there's all sorts of different things in there.
Yeah, I think I've always been really interested in like taking, you know, a trope or something like a zombie thing and kind of putting my own spin on it. But I also wanted to kind of, in putting the collection together and figuring out the theme specifically, I thought about the theme of my first collection, which was how people react to different things. That was the title of the first collection is People, a horror anthology about love, lost life, and things that go bump in the night. So like, I thought about the people themselves, the characters themselves in these circumstances and how they would react, whether naturally or not. Whereas in this one, the people were more of a conduit for the emotion of the whatever it was, like the fear that was going on. So in the case with the zombies, while yes, they are a major feature of that particular story in that collection, it's more about how the people that are stuck in this very tiny space react to one another and how they deal with the fear of what's going on outside in the world. So in coming up with the theme, I just thought about what I was afraid of and the fears that I had and have, and just kind of wanted to play on my own fears a bit.
And I was also thinking as well, like thinking about the one with one of the stories, the one with the zombies, Elevator of the Dead. Quite a few of your stories end on like cliffhangers or end quite abruptly. Have you ever thought about like doing sequels or like expanding that story? Is that in your mind at all, or do you just like want them to end like?
I think I've always liked the idea of building a larger universe with the writing. In my first collection, everything takes place in this very, you know, similar type area, or the characters that are not in that area are from that area, and it's a fictional town. I carry that through into this collection a little bit as well, but I also expand. So I like the idea of a bigger universe, and I like the idea of ending on a cliffhanger, because it keeps you, you know, hopefully you want a little bit more, or hopefully it gets you thinking about that world a little bit. And if I can get you to do that, then hopefully I've done my job. Yeah, Elevator of the Dead is a good example. That certainly has a pretty cliffhangery ending.
yeah, absolutely. Because it is one of those stories where you almost think like, oh, it's really going to take off here, and then you're like, oh no, it's onto the next one.
I think, and you know what's, I was thinking too a lot about and we were talking about this before we started recording. I was thinking about the Creepshow movie. Mm-hmm. Too, how some of those really have kind of a real nasty, almost cliffhanger type ending. Think of like the one with the part with the roaches, right?
Oh, in
the,
yeah.
You know, like that ends, and yes, that guy is clearly dead. But like, did this happen? Did it not happen? Was he just nuts? Were these things real? Where did they go? Like, where did the roaches go? Like, what was the force behind it? Why did this happen all of a sudden? So, you know, I like having some questions at the end of my stories. I've definitely thought about, you know, certain sequels and stuff like that. I wrote Elevator of the Dead specifically because I had a couple readers get in touch with me asking me if I was going to have a zombie story in the next collection. And I was like, I never, you know, I wrote 4 zombie screenplays for fun. So I at least used to like zombies a lot. So I guess I'll try it. And that's kind of where it came from.
You were talking as well about like liking to put your own kind of unique hook onto something. I was wondering, is that something that initially put you off writing a zombie tale? You know, just the kind of oversaturation in culture of zombies, particularly in the last decade.
I think so. I think that's probably why I didn't want to try it for so long, just because I feel like everything that is original with zombies is very difficult to do without changing the formula dramatically. Like we referenced in our chat before, we referenced Blood Quantum. Well, the zombies in that are not dramatically different than any other zombies, but it's everything else in that movie that's so dramatically different, you know, from the setting on a Native American reservation to indigenous peoples being immune to the virus or whatever you want to call it. Like, all of that is interesting, you know? And how things really, in that movie, seem to be going well. Like, they're not going well, but going well for the people who are safely behind the walls, you know? So taking something and trying to add a bit of spice to it or a bit of originality to it was key. And I'd never really seen anything like Elevator of the Dead before. You could probably guess, listeners, that it's about a group... I said it in a tiny space. You could probably guess that it's about a group of people stuck in an elevator during the zombie apocalypse. But I had never really seen anything like that before, so I wondered how that might be.
Yeah, and I don't think I've not seen any zombie movies. There's no zombie movie equivalent of like Phone Booth, you know, like there's. So no, it's an interesting take on it. Going back to the kind of cliffhanger thing, were you at all worried that people might be put off or perturbed by that, or just being like, oh, I feel kind of ripped off? You know, I was like, oh, you know, I was just getting into that.
I think, yeah. I sometimes will worry that people won't be happy with some of the stories when they just kind of end abruptly, or they don't continue just a little bit further. But I can see people being upset by that. But I can't. I write for me where the story ends. That's where it ends. So, like in the case of Elevator of the Dead, when it ends in that particular way. Yeah, there could be a lot more, you know, that could be a whole novella itself probably. But then again, at the same time, like, you know, I don't know if people like the lead character enough to want to spend more time with him. I liked him. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody else did, you know? So I know I've read some short stories that have gone on. They've like outstayed their welcome a little bit. So I don't want to fall into that trap, but I guess it's always better to leave people wanting more than it is to disappoint them.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, like if people actually care enough to want a follow up, then that's, you've obviously done something right.
Thank you.
There is some kind of unusual inclusions in the collection as well. I would say in terms of you know, I mean, I can understand maybe where they came from, but like, you know, something like Green Gospel, which is quite. Is like utopian, you know, it's somewhat utopian, you know, like that seems, it kind of stands out as like in amongst all these kind of horror tales. Why include something like that as well?
Yeah, Green Gospel, I you know, because I would love a utopia like that personally, and I'm assuming you would as well. You and I seem to have quite a bit in common. But I also wanted to kind of play around with the idea of like losing oneself to the notion of a utopia, becoming less the individual who exists in the utopia and then just becomes part of the concept, sort of like how you know, in 1984, there's no individual thought and whatnot is pretty much squashed, you know, and everybody's just part of the system. And I wanted to kind of invent a utopia where everybody's sort of part of the system. And while, yes, it's vastly superior to the, you know, the awfulness going on now, the loss of individuality and the loss of who we are is also a bad thing. So yeah. That's kind of where that one came from.
Right. I can certainly see that, you know, from the from having read it. Yeah. I saw that, you know, there's a little bit of kind of sly satire in there as well. You know, like everybody these in the start of the thing, it's like this kind of force of nature that like really causes the kind of the change, but all these people are kind of patting themselves on the back and assuming it's their individual thing at the start, which I thought was quite fun.
the original name for that story was Destroyed by Hippie Powers.
Okay.
Because I love the band Car Seat Headrest, and they have a song called Destroyed by Hippie Powers. And I couldn't stop thinking about that title. I was like, oh, that's really good. And then I was like, I don't know if I should name it after that song, because it's not really like Hippie Powers. So I changed it to Green Gospel.
Actually, the other story that I feel kind of stands out, you know, in terms of like it not being precisely horror, I mean, there's an element of horror in it, is a story directly before the Green Gospel, Full Understanding, which is less a horror, it's more a kind of, it made me think of Borges, you know, like a kind of philosophical inquiry, rather than a horror tale, but like obviously a philosophical inquiry that is quite depressing and therefore has a horror within it.
Yeah, can you imagine just the idea of you know, every day having that, just having knowledge, just knowing everything. You know, and I've thought about this for, like, I guess 2 weeks or so, how nightmarish your life would really be. And that's kind of what I wanted to express with this character. And I was like, well, what's the one thing that this guy wouldn't know about? And that's the one thing that he wants to cause, because that's the only thing that, you know, he's not thirsty for anything because he knows everything. And he's experienced everything without ever having to do it. So this one thing is what he's looking for. And, and this has happened twice that I've thought about, you know, another character, how boring it might be to be them. And I was thinking of Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen.
That's funny you should say that, because like when I read this story, as well as the Borges thing, I was also thinking about Dr. Manhattan. I was,
yeah.
Because I genuinely wondered if the story would follow the kind of Dr. Manhattan trajectory. And obviously, that is a spoiler if you know the comic book Watchmen. But if you don't, you don't know what we're talking about.
I'm a huge Watchmen fan. I have a Watchmen tattoo and everything. So, I wear my Watchmen love literally on my arm or on my sleeve, but I thought about that as well, but I, you know, obviously I wanted to kind of put it more in a human perspective too, but that was definitely when I started thinking about the story. I was like, oh yeah, like think about Dr. Manhattan, think about the tragedy of Dr. Manhattan, and putting that in a more human context, I was like, this is the only way I could ever see anybody like this going. Which is, it is horrible, but is it horror, like you said? Not, it might be a little more weird lit than it is horror, for sure.
Yeah, I think it certainly falls in under that category, for sure. But but I suppose it ties in with, you know, the theme you gave about like fears and, you know, being about all different types of fears, whether it's environmental fears or economic fears or fears of, you know, addiction, you know, addiction to games and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That, yeah. It kind of makes sense when I now know, and the listeners now know, the kind of overriding theme of the collection. I was also noting that in the middle of the collection, roughly in the middle, there's a couple of stories, panels and support that are kind of comedy. They are quite comedic in a way that most of the tales aren't. Was that a kind of deliberate thing of placing that roughly in the middle of it? It's kind of giving, it's like, here's a little breather for you.
Yeah, absolutely. A nice palate cleanser. You know, you're going from a 30-year, you know, red wine to a rosé, something to kind of switch it up a little bit. But yeah, just I do like to put a little more humor into things. This collection is, I hope that there's like at least a little bit of humor in it. But that was definitely done on purpose to kind of break it up. My editor, thankfully, he comes up with the order of everything, and he was like, I think that this should go here after the first half. let's give them something to cleanse the palate a little bit.
Yeah, because I mean they're quite noticeably different in tone. You know, obviously they're really quite light and jolly. And again, you know, like, so is that something that you just, you know, you're in kind of conversation with your editor in terms of like, you know, there's obviously tonal shifts throughout the collection, and this is kind of like a major one in terms of like it just being that much lighter in tone. And did you just kind of work that out between the two of you, just in terms of like not throwing the reader off too much, or not, you know, kind of chucking them out the reading experience, or, you know, like how careful were you in terms of that?
That's a great question. And he, his name is Louis Morisi. He really did. When he's reading, he likes to update me as he's reading sometimes, and he'll tell me, you know, this story just doesn't, going from this particular story to this story, because originally it went the opening novella, and then it went the Sugar Bowl, which the two of them back to back probably would not have worked. But then, you know, he started playing around with the idea of changing that a little bit. And then we settled on the order that it's in, because he takes into consideration, like, you don't want to have these two types of stories back to back. You don't want to overwhelm the reader with, you know, these particular feelings compared to these particular feelings. You don't want to overwhelm them in terms of like too many jokey ones in a row. Sometimes, you know, his feeling is it could be good to kind of intersperse them throughout. But in this case, I think, you know, with him doing like first half and then here's the intermission and then here's the rest of it, you know, it gives the reader a chance to breathe a little bit. And he's really adept at piecing that together. And I know there's another story in there that has like a little bit of a, in my mind, even though it involves some pretty dark material, it has a little bit more of, it has almost like a love story aspect to it. And I'm pretty sure he put that one in the middle. I'd have to check my copy of it, but it's I know that he wanted to put that up towards the beginning a little bit more, and I think he ended up putting it a little bit more towards the middle. It's the one with the teachers.
I can't remember the exact order, but yes.
I know it's weird when you think about these things, and even like I'm the guy who wrote it, but like, you know, like I said, he changed the order considerably. So I literally looked everything over and I was like, yeah, this works for me. If it works for you, it works for me. And like, I give him a lot of credit with the editorial process. He's a dream to work with. And, he was really great with, you know, we edited another book that we published as well from another author, not just mine. And he was really great with that as well. So he's really something special, especially when it comes to putting things together in the right order or getting it. He's a good reader more so than he is a good editor. Like, he's a great editor, but his reading and his intuitiveness in terms of the pacing of story and the notes that one hits with a story, that's invaluable. You know, an editor's an editor. They're going to do a good job. They're going to check all your syntax and all that, you know, little mistakes that you make, whatever. But when you have someone who's a legitimate reader who cares about the written word in the way that my editor does, they really get a better sense for the emotion behind the words, not just the narrative itself.
And I was going into some more of the stories. Obviously, most of them are in various different horror genres. Most of them have like supernatural elements or elements of the fantastical. But I was wondering, it seems like the story You Can't Walk It Back is very much just like a personal fear of something that might happen.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that one up. You Can't Walk It Back is, and we're actually living in this right now. We're actually seeing the reaction to this. I worry about the notion of cancel culture. That's what that story is really about. And the idea of cancel culture and stuff like that. We saw it happen to James Gunn, the director. Like, Disney canceled him. and he came back, and you know, he's making the Suicide Squad sequel, and then he's going to be making Guardians 3, so they brought him back. And so I worry about the concepts behind cancel culture, especially when there is a sincere, and I was talking about this actually last night, when there is like a sincere note of apology or opportunity to correct one's behavior, you know, by being too hasty with cancel culture, or you know, the I think they were calling it pause culture for a while as well. Yeah. If an individual, you know, does show true, legitimate sorrow at their actions, and they are taking steps to be better, I think that's a good thing. You know, James Gunn admitted that the jokes that he made were awful, and they're very stupid, and they were made when he was younger and less intelligent. I think that's more than enough, you know, to say like, okay, well, he's not, you know, he's not abusing anybody, you know? So that story was written in that kind of vein.
Yeah. And I can certainly see that. And I'm certainly no fan of Twitter pylons or any sort of thing like that, where you know, people just jump on a certain individual.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if somebody shows genuine contrition and learning, I think that should be taken into account for sure. Although I would say though that cancel culture does seem to be, like, as a title, it is a little bit of a misnomer.
Mm-hmm.
Because like a lot of people aren't cancelled. You know, lots of people, right, who are cancelled aren't cancelled. Mel Gibson, right, has been cancelled, you know, a dozen, yeah, times over. And, you know, he still makes movies. You know, he's still, you know, he makes maybe less. He's maybe in kind of less bigger budget productions than he might have been 20 years ago. But still, he's making a decent living, and he's in plenty, yeah, of things, and he shows no sign of any contrition, and he's, you know what I mean?
No, absolutely.
And there's absolutely also this thing as well of, like, I think the other side of it is lots of people who complain about cancel culture are just wanting to say their opinion, but wanting to say it unchallenged. So. You know, and lots of people who complain about it, there's this central irony of, like, you know, you get people like, you know, doing, it's in, for example, in stand-up comedy, there's lots, mm-hmm, of comedians who joke about cancel culture,
mm-hmm,
which is fine, you know, like, feel free to joke about anything you want to. However, there is these people like a Ricky Gervais or a Dave Chappelle who basically are saying, you can't make jokes about anything nowadays. And, mm-hmm, they're seeing it in their, you know, their Netflix special, which is part of their multi-special, multi-million Netflix deal. So clearly, you fucking can.
And, you know, and you raise a good point, too, because, you know, some of the people who have been canceled certainly deserve it. You know, Mel Gibson is somebody who deserves to not work. You know, great. Okay, I appreciate the Mad Max movies. Thank you. Signs, in my opinion, is a total masterpiece, and it's M. Night Shyamalan's best movie. But you work in Hollywood, and you have really horrifying opinions about people who are of the Jewish faith. That's not okay. Like, that's not okay, man. Like, you can't be in a public position as an actor and say something so nasty about an entire group of people. You know, so I agree with you about that, but he still works somehow. I don't know how that happens, but I agree with you that it's, you know, they're making a living talking about cancel culture, but you know what? They are funny. Dave Chappelle and Ricky Gervais are both funny, so.
I disagree with you and Ricky Gervais, but like.
Really?
Yeah, I've never liked Ricky Gervais.
I like him popping up on the American Office more than I like him on the British Office.
Right. Okay. Okay. I've never watched the American Office, and I didn't like the British Office.
I put off watching it for like a decade. My girlfriend made me watch the whole thing, and I was surprised that I actually liked it. Yeah. But I was thinking too,
I'm also very surprised. Like, you know, we won't fall too far down this kind of comedy rabbit hole. But I do find it amazing because I think Dave Chappelle was funnier back in the day, but I still think he is very funny at times. And I just don't understand how a comedian who is so razor sharp on like politics and race can be so tone deaf about other things. Like,
right.
all of his material about trans people is horrific. It's just mm-hmm. like, you know, like he's so tone deaf about it. And yeah. like, I just don't understand how somebody who's has such can be so such a clear thinker on certain topics, but just be absolutely, yeah, that's my opinion.
No, I that's so funny that you say that. It's amazing how that happens, right? Like when you have somebody you really admire and you really respect, and then they have the dumbest opinion on something, and it's like, oh dude, no, come on. Can't you just think everything the way that I do? Somebody that, you know, you really admire.
I know.
It sucks. I'm trying to think of a similar case or whatever where somebody was like, yeah, 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 everything you're saying is great. And then they were like, oh, no, 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 wait.
It's a bit like that moment where you have a friend and you're like, and they're like, they're on the spectrum with you, you know, they've got similar things in movies and politics and like they seem like an all-round intelligent person, and you're like, oh, this person could, and then you find out they're an anti-vaxxer and you're like, ah, oh, fuck.
I actually ended a friendship with a guy because he didn't like the movie Man of Steel, so I get it.
Wow.
Yeah. He was railing against it. And I was like, you're making a mistake. You're making a mistake. And then I never talked to him again.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So, yeah. So, I mean, we don't agree on everything. Like, Man of Steel is fine, but that's it. It's all that's you're awesome. Getting out of me. Oh, okay. So to go back to, your writing, how did you first get into like horror writing? When did you first decide that, you know, like, oh, I want to do this?
I'd done a lot of like screenwriting and playwriting and stuff like that back in the day. And I wrote I guess the first horror thing that I wrote was a zombie script. And it was such a ripoff of the Resident Evil movie with Mila Jovovich or whatever. It was so bad. It's like one of the worst things I've ever written. But instead of having like the amazing Mila Jovovich as a lead, it has like some guy in a leather jacket. And I don't know what I was thinking. It's really bad. So that was like one of the first horror things that I wrote. And
did you write it in the early 2000s by any chance?
Of course, I did.
Everybody had a leather jacket.
Yeah, absolutely.
Post-Matrix, everyone had a leather jacket. Yeah.
So I went from that, and when I was in college, I wrote a short survival horror play, a piece for the stage that I might turn into a short story at some point, but it, you know, the horror aspect of really comes from the survival and sort of some body horror type stuff that happens. But I wrote that, and I got some recognition for it. I it was performed in LA, it was performed in the city, in New York City, and, you know, a few other places. So I was really proud of it. And that was really when I realized, like, I can do, you know, writers can do so much with horror. We can talk about so many different things. And so I, you know, went on the back burner for a long time with, you know, I became a journalist and stuff like that. And I covered a local serial killer that has never been caught here on Long Island. And so obviously there was an element of horror there. And then I became a teacher, and every day has an element of horror. So I figured writing it was always something I had in me. Then my father passed away in 2019, and I wrote my first book, my first collection of short stories, as a way to kind of process my emotion and sort of exercise my demons about losing my dad. And that's kind of really where it started after that was published. And I've been writing ever since. I try to write every day, and usually it's horror based. I'm working on a young adult novel right now that is very much a horror, murder mystery kind of thing. So it's in everything that I write. I just find horror to be so much fun, and I find it to be like the most therapeutic way of writing than anything else. I can't imagine writing like a life-affirming memoir or a life-affirming family drama or anything like that. I just that sounds so boring to me. So
why does it resonate with you the most, do you think, as a genre?
I think because I grew up watching so much of it with, you know, as a little kid, I watched so much with my parents. I remember watching Jaws as a child, my dad's favorite movie, and, you know, living on Long Island. And, you know, we all have a very healthy fear of the ocean because of that movie, everybody on Long Island. But seeing the power of something like that, or seeing the power of Alien, or seeing, you know, the strength of something like The Exorcist or whatever the case may be, these movies like stay with you. You can watch a comedy and you can quote a comedy, and that's great, and you have a good time with your friends, you know, quoting whatever funny movie. But at the end of the day, like, the horror movies are the ones that ask questions, or at the very least, they leave you feeling a certain way. Like, it can't be In the Fall. Like, you can't be In the Fall and not worry that Michael Myers is hiding in the bushes nearby once you've seen Halloween. And you can't be at the beach and not wonder if there's a 25-foot great white shark in the depths. And there's no other genre that does that.
Yeah, I mean, like, there is that certain thing of, like, certain things go through your mind, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, when you've seen a horror movie, and like you say, there is that kind of resonance there of, like, yeah, you know, you go down to the beach and, you know, you think about sharks, even if you know that there's not going to be any sharks. Mm-hmm. You know, or you go to a hotel, and if you go and the shower has a shower curtain, you know, like, there's a little bit of you that's like, you know, just the psycho pops into your head, and, like, you know, obviously nobody's it's very, very unlikely that somebody
hopefully not
stab you in the shower. But, you know, like, it runs through your mind.
it absolutely does. You're totally right. But, like, you have to think of it too. Like, fear is our most primal instinct, right? As humans, it is the one thing that our cavemen ancestors and our pre-caveman ancestors had strong reaction to. You know, the fight or flight mechanism is in all of us. And fear, and I say this all the time, because I, you know, when I'm teaching, I really get excited when I get to read a scary story. I just did. I'm teaching summer school, I taught summer school rather, and I taught Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. And getting the students to read that was wonderful, but also letting them know, you know, the idea of these fear is something that's always going to be in us. Like, even if everything's a utopia, the fear then becomes, well, what if this ends? And what are we going to do? And the fear is always going to be there. So fear is a thing that we can all connect to. You know, we could say, well, I'm not afraid of that. Like, the biggest, toughest guys, you know. But they are afraid of something. Everybody's afraid of something.
Yeah, that's very true. And I suppose the other thing, you know, some of the films that you mentioned there, there's, like, breadth to horror. You know, I've discussed this with other guests in the podcast of, like, horror is often the vehicle in which to ask bigger questions. You know, but before the podcast, we were talking about Dawn of the Dead, which is a zombie movie, but it's a zombie movie that is a satire on capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned The Exorcist. The Exorcist is a horror movie with a possession, but is essentially about a man's struggle with his faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that these, you know, it's a pill, you know, a sweet pill in order to, you know, talk about other things like as well.
Right. And there's no other genre that does that. You know, a courtroom drama is great, but at the end of the day, a courtroom drama, you're hung up on whether something is going to, you know, Like, is the person going to jail or not is really the only question in a brilliant courtroom drama, something like, A Few Good Men or something like that. But horror has so much more. The idea, and we talked about, Night of the Living Dead being about, the revenge of the oppressed, about, civil rights movement, that kind of thing. But when horror can do that, and I think that's what's missing sometimes in a lot of horror also, like that's part of what misses the mark for me a lot of the time with especially some modern stuff, when there's no message behind it, that is kind of a bummer to me. I just watched a movie, it's on Shudder. It's I loved it. It's, oh my God, what is it called? Starts with an L. It's got Gabby Hoffman. It's sort of like a modern Rosemary's Baby. It's incredible. It's literally about an hour long. But when you look at that and you look at something like Rosemary's Baby and you realize like, okay, yes, this is about a woman who's pregnant with the devil. Okay, great. But it's really not. It's about the fear that a woman has being pregnant. And it's about the ravages on the human body during pregnancy. Like that's what Rosemary's Baby is about, and that's what makes it so enduring and so amazing all these years later,
absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned modern horror there, because like I feel like there is more of that, particularly in the last kind of, I would say maybe 5 years, of we've kind of gone back again. There was obviously particularly in the kind of 2000s, there was a lot of horror movies that were just horror movies, but there obviously has been these movies like Get Out and Hereditary, which are, and things like that, that are talking about other things, again, Get Out is a kind of race satire. The, Hereditary is really a movie about grief and trauma, as much as it is a horror movie.
Right. I think I'm the only person who didn't like Hereditary.
I think lots of people didn't like Hereditary for various reasons. I do think it is, as much as it was critically praised and as much as I like it, I think it was pretty divisive in the kind of horror fan base.
I also admit freely that I really should watch it again. I really should, just to give it another chance. But I agree, like the movies, Hereditary, like you said, Hereditary. What was the one after Hereditary? Midsommar.
Midsommar.
Which I liked Midsommar a little bit more, but I also read Midsommar very differently than a lot of people have. But I also, I think of sometimes like a movie with nothing to say. A movie like, there's that other one that's on Shudder that just came out not super long ago about the college kids. Oh, it's like The Booth or something like that. They're all... The Confessional. The Confessional. The movie has nothing to say. And it's awful. And I just don't see the value of something like that, whereas the same service is putting out something like Dogs Don't Wear Pants, which is a masterpiece, or Blood Quantum, which is a masterpiece, and just these brilliant movies that do have a message behind them. The Siren, there's so many good ones. And then something like that comes out, and it's like, well, this is just 80 minutes of blah, So like for me, I like to spend my time, and I'm sure you do as well. I mean, you talk to a lot of brilliant filmmakers, and I've discovered a lot of great movies because of your podcast, and for that I thank you. But The Wretched, for example, floored.
Yeah. No, that's I remember talking to Drew and Brett. It's a good film, that.
Oh, I loved it. But again, I've discovered so much through your show, and to spend time with something that is not as much of value. I see, like in my writing, I don't want to waste someone's time reading a story. And maybe there'll be some, there's always going to be some duds in a collection. Like I've read, collections by guys like Brian Evanson and other, Stephen King, for God's sake. Like there's always a couple stories that don't always work, at least one or two. And that's okay, because they're surrounded by stories for you that hopefully do. So I feel the same way about horror and film as well. Like, okay, maybe this wasn't your best effort, but hopefully the next thing or the thing before it is of value,
It's funny you should mention, you're reading different collections by different authors there. I feel like within your writing, from talking to you, that you actually get a lot of your influences from movies rather than literature. But is there kind of horror literature that you draw influence from as well?
You'd be right. I definitely am influenced by film more than literature. I have more of a visual sense, I think, than maybe other writers. I don't know. Like, I just see things so clearly in my head, and I do my best to try to put it on the paper. But the yes, there are a bunch of writers that I do love. John Langan, I adore. Brian Evanson, I mentioned him. I oh my God. Those are just two horror or weird lit authors there. Bret Easton Ellis is my hero, the guy who wrote American Psycho. And American Psycho is not my favorite of his books, but I adore him, desperately adore him. Chad Culchin is another great writer. There's so many that have influenced me as well. I just read my first Stephen King fiction book, like not super long ago, as an adult, and it was Thinner. I read Thinner.
Right.
And I loved it. I was like, now I get it. Not that I didn't get it before, of course, but like, you know, I just want more. I want more of it, you know? It's such a cliche.
I've not read Thinner, so I don't know. I have seen the movie, which is rubbish. I take it as better than the movie.
It's funny you say that, because I watched the movie before I read the book too, and I was like, as I was reading the book, I was like, you know, this is just so much. It's just more interesting. Like, there's little nuance in the book that really could have translated well to the movie, and they just didn't do it. I do like the guy who plays the lead. He was one of the RoboCops. I do like him a lot, but yeah, it's not a great movie.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, in terms of the movies of Stephen King adaptations, it's very hit and miss.
Yeah, I think it's tough to top The Shawshank Redemption, of course. Like, that's just an unbridled masterpiece. But it's, you know, then you have something like Thinner. I actually just watched Needful Things not long ago too, and I loved it. I loved Needful Things.
I've never seen that. No.
It's quite good. Yeah, give it a chance. Talk about, you know, Max von Sydow is in that. He's excellent.
He's turned up in all sorts, isn't he?
Yeah, right.
Hats off to the sadly deceased Max von Sydow for the, you know, like, a kind of stunning career trajectory that you can fit The Seventh Seal and Flash Gordon into one career.
And the voice of Viggo the Carpathian from Ghostbusters 2.
Exactly. Max von Sydow, we salute you for your
damn right. Think of that though. Think of that image, right? And we, you know, talking about the idea of being influenced by film, perhaps more than literature. Just the image of him getting out of the cab and stepping into the light of the bedroom window in The Exorcist. My God, there's no frame of film in the horror genre. There's no more powerful frame than that. And it's literally a representative of faith about to take on what's perceived to be the ultimate evil. It's just so, it's like, Jesus. It's no pun intended, but like, it's just so incredible.
It's pretty amazing. It is amazing. I was also going to ask you, because the collection spans so many different types of horror, you know, as I said at the way back at the beginning, there, you know, there's body horror, there's zombies, there's vampires, there's survival horror, there's all sorts of different things going on. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite type of horror, or do you just kind of love it all?
I do. I'm such a sucker for a good haunted house story. I just love ghosts. I love demonology. You know, things of an infernal nature I really enjoy. I love the idea of monsters that just shouldn't exist, things that are impossible. And even some of the, you know, I don't know, do they use this term in Scotland, cryptids?
Cryptids.
Yeah, like you know, Bigfoot, you know, Bigfoot, right?
Yes, I am aware. I'm aware.
Yeah, stuff like that. Oh, I guess in Scotland you would have the Loch Ness Monster.
Correct, yes.
Right. So, you know, talking about things like that, like these monsters that people have supposedly seen and perhaps building some sort of horror around that. I love that kind of stuff. But nothing, there's nothing better to me than a good, spooky haunted house tale. You know, I live on Long Island. The Amityville Horror happened about 20 minutes away from me. So it's hard to top.
And that's very true. I was so, I suppose, like, you're working on a young adult novel, you were saying? Or is that the only thing you're working on at the moment? Are you any other projects kind of in the air for you at the moment?
I'm working on a YA murder mystery horror novel that I've been I've been talking to some agents and stuff like that, and they say not to use this, but I'm sort of writing what I'm thinking is like Gone Girl, but for 16-year-olds. So that's kind of my thinking with that, but they say not to say Gone Girl because it's like an overused thing, but that's kind of what I'm working on now. I'm also compiling a third collection of short fiction. The difference is 80 to 90% of the stories that are going to be in that third collection are stories that have been published elsewhere already. That's the biggest difference. So it's, instead of going in to the third collection with the trajectory of, I'm going to write these stories for this collection, this is more of a collection of things that have been available in other places. So it's going to be a little bit different tonally than the first two.
And does that have a kind of central theme like this one as well? You know, obviously we've discussed the theme of just kind of fears, of everyday fears, of, you know, paranormal fear, you know, like all that kind of thing. Does this have a kind of central theme to it? And can you tell us what that is, or are you willing to impart?
Sure. I guess if there is a central theme of that, of this, the newer collection that would be coming out or that I'm putting together right now, it would be about ignoring who you are, trying to be something that you're not.
And does it span as many different types of horror as this collection, or is it more in a certain wheelhouse of a certain type?
I think there are some more monsters, or there are more creatures in this newer collection. A lot of the stories that I've sold have more elements of monster fiction or creature fiction to them. So there are more elements of that. So if you like my writing about monsters, then you'll probably like this collection that I'm putting together now. But I'm also working on my first full-length, straight-up horror novel as well.
And can you tell us anything about that, or do you just want to keep that under your hat?
It has a lot to do with rejecting something that is supposed to be an ingrained concept in who we are as people. It has a lot to do with not being connected to something that we are all automatically supposed to connect to once it happens. That's really all I can kind of hint at.
Okay. No problem.
I know that's pretty nebulous. I'm sorry.
That's all right. You know, if it's in the early stages, then that's fine. We don't want you to give away anything you don't want to give away. In terms of, lastly, before we go on out, is the YA novel and the third collection, do they have titles that you can give us?
Yeah, the YA novel is called Missing White Girl, and the third collection that'll be coming out, you know, and it's going to take a little bit of time, but the third collection is going to be called The Dark Flowers.
And when can we expect to see them? Or do we have a kind of timeline on when we could expect to see them coming out, maybe sometime in 2021?
The Dark Flowers will probably be out in late 2021 or early 2022. Because there's a lot of contracts connected to the stories that are going to be in it. And once those contracts expire, they can go into the collection. But the YA novel, not yet.
Okay. No, nothing on that. One last question before we go. I was wondering, at the very beginning of this collection, Her Infernal Names and Other Stories, there is a QR code for a Spotify playlist created by you. what inspired you to do that?
That's so cool that you took a look at that. I always write to music. I had a lot of writing teachers in college and stuff tell me that that's not a good idea, but I always did it. And I always found that music really informed my writing. I'm actually, there's a piece that's going to be on horrortree.com about putting together a soundtrack and a playlist to what you write that I wrote. But yeah, I've always wanted to kind of share the influences with people. So the soundtrack that I put together for Her Infernal Name and Other Nightmares and stuff is all sort of story beats to me, and like sort of the kind of music that the characters in the collection would probably be listening to. There's like a Fleetwood Mac needle drop in there. That's referenced in the title novella. But yeah, I love the idea of like bringing people into the process as much as possible.
Is that something you might do in the future as well? Into, you know, in making it kind of that more immersive experience, kind of.
Yeah, I definitely would like to. What's that? I'm sorry.
Audio-visual experience of reading and listening at the same time.
Yeah, I definitely would love to do something like that. I know that I sort of see it like, hopefully if people are reading and they're listening to music at the same time, maybe they'll throw the playlist on and hopefully they'll pick up like the same kind of vibe that I'm throwing down for them. And that's sort of like what I sort of present. DC Comics a while back did a thing where they had playlists that they put together based on some of the titles during the really not very good Convergence timeline that they were putting together. And I thought the idea was neat, but their execution was terrible. So I wanted this to be a little more personal and bespoke, like in terms of me putting it together, and have it be something that, you know, you can really pick up if you're reading and listening at the same time. It's definitely something that you'll make the connection to. It definitely was like that in the first book too. I have the QR code in the first book also, and those are all songs that I wrote the two books to, both of those soundtracks.
Excellent. Well, that's all for this interview. I think that's a cool note to end on. So thank you very much, Rob, for coming on the show. And please do feel free to come back on when the other books are out.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan. I love the show. And like I said, I you're a great source of discovering new horror and new talent and stuff like that. And so many great filmmakers and whatnot have appeared. And I thank you for doing it. I literally just stumbled across your podcast one day on iTunes. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. So I thank you so much again.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rob. That was my guest Robert there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest edition of New Horror Express. That's all for this time, but be sure to join us again on Thursday when we will have another edition of our Guilty Pleasure series, this time looking at Jason X, alongside former guests Adam Stovall and Abe Goldfarb. Until then, though, see ya!